solve a big problem. On the other hand, if you get in our way now, we could make things tough for you later. In the future, I mean. All kinds of different ways. For instance, what do you do for a living?
What help? Hogan said.
We're looking for a man and a woman. He's older, she's younger. She's petite and dark-haired. He's big and ugly.
Deal with it, Reacher thought. Don't make me come downstairs.
Why are you looking for them? Hogan asked.
The guy at the door said, We think they're in terrible danger. We need to warn them. For their own sake. We're trying to help. It's what we do.
We haven't seen them.
You sure?
100%.
One more thing you could do, the guy said.
What?
Call us if you see them. Would you do that for us?
No answer from Hogan.
It's not much to ask, the guy said. Either you feel like helping us out with a 10-second phone call, or you don't, I guess. Either way is fine. It's a free country. We'll make a note and move right along.
Okay, Hogan said. We'll call.
Thanks. Anytime, night or day. Don't delay.
Okay, Hogan said again.
One last thing.
What?
Another way you could help me out.
How?
Obviously, I'm going to report this address as what we call in our business a place of zero concern. Targets clearly not there. Just regular folks going about their regular business, and so on and so forth.
Good, Hogan said.
But in our business, we take process very seriously. We like numbers. At some point, I'm sure to be asked, with what exact degree of confidence do I make that assessment?
100%, Hogan said again.
I hear you. But at the end of the day, that's just a verbal report by an interested party.
All you got.
My point exactly, the guy said. It would really help me out if I could take a walk through your property and see for myself. Then we got a foundation of solid evidence to go on. Case closed. We wouldn't need to bother you again. Maybe you would get an invitation to the July 4th picnic. One of the family now. A solid guy who helps out.
It's not my property, Hogan said. I rent a room. I don't think I have the authority.
Maybe the other gentleman in the living room.
You need to take our word for it, and you need to leave now.
Don't worry about the weed, the guy said. Is that it? I could smell it down the street. I don't care about weed. I'm not a cop. I'm not here to bust you. I'm a representative from the local mutual aid society. We work hard in the community. We achieve impressive results.
Take our word for it. Hogan said again.
Who else is in the house?
No one.
Been alone all night?
We had people over for the evening.
What people?
Friends, Hogan said. We had Chinese food and a little wine.
Did they stay over?
No.
How many friends?
Two.
A man and a woman, by any chance?
Not the man and woman you're looking for.
How do you know?
Because they can't be. They're just regular folks, like you said.
You sure they didn't stay over?
I saw them leave.
Okay, the guy said. Then you have nothing to worry about. I'll just take a quick glance around. I'll know right away, anyway. I have some experience in these matters. I was a police detective back in Tirana. Usually I found it impossible for a person to be in a house without leaving visible clues somewhere, including about who they were and why they were there.
Hogan had no answer. Reacher and Abby heard footsteps in the hallway directly below them. The guy had stepped inside. Abby whispered, "I can't believe Hogan let him in. Obviously, this guy will look everywhere. It won't be a quick glance around. Hogan fell for it."
"Hogan is doing fine," Reacher said. "He's a U.S. Marine. He has a sound grasp of strategy. He gave us plenty of time to get dressed and make the bed and get the window open so that right about now, as the guy steps inside, we climb outside and we hide on the roof or in the yard, and the guy doesn't find us and he goes away happy, all without a single moment of confrontation. The best fights are the ones you don't have. Even Marines understand that."
"But we're not climbing out the window. We're just standing here. We're not following the plan."
"There might be an alternative approach."
"Like what?"
"Maybe something more Army than Marine Corps."
"Like what?" she said again.
"Let's wait and see what happens," he said. Below them, they heard the guy tramp his way into the parlor. They heard him say, "You're musicians?"
"Yes."
"You play our clubs?"
"Yes."
"Not anymore, unless your attitude improves."
No reply. Silence for a second. Then from above, they heard the guy move out to the hallway again and onward into the kitchen.
"Chinese food," they heard him say. "Lots of containers. You were telling the truth."
"Plus wine," Hogan said, "like I told you." They heard a clink. Two empty bottles, picked up or knocked together or otherwise examined or inspected or disturbed. Then, silence. Then they heard the guy say, "What's this?" They heard the air suck out of the room. No sound at all. Until they heard the guy answer his own question. They heard him say, "It's a scrap of paper with the Albanian word for ugly written on it."
Chapter 30 Reacher and Abby stepped out the bedroom door to the upstairs hallway. Below them in the kitchen, there was no sound, just some kind of silent tension, hissing and crackling off the tile. Reacher pictured worried glances, Barton to Hogan, Hogan to Barton. Abby whispered, "We should go down there and help them out."
"We can't," Reacher said. "If that guy sees us here, we can't let him leave."
"Why not?"
"He would report back. This address would be blown forever. Barton could get all kinds of problems in the future. They would stop him playing their clubs for sure. Hogan, too, same boat. They gotta eat."
Then he paused. Abby said, "What do you mean, can't let him leave?"
"There are a number of options."
"You mean take him prisoner?"
"Maybe this house has a cellar."
"What are the other options?"
"There's a range. I'm pretty much a whatever works kind of guy."
Abby said, "I guess this is my fault. I shouldn't have left the paper."
"You were defending me. It was nice of you."
"Still a mistake."
"Spilled milk," Reacher said. "Move on. Don't waste mental energy." Below them, the conversation started up again. They heard the guy ask, "Are you learning a new language?" No answer.
"Probably better not to start with Albanian. And probably better not to start with this particular word. It's kind of subtle. It has a bunch of meanings. Country people use it. I guess originally it's an old folk word from long ago. It's quite rare now. Not used often."
No response.
"Why did you write it on a scrap of paper?"
No reply.
"Actually, I don't think you did. I think this is a woman's handwriting. I told you, I have experience in these matters. I was a police detective in Tirana. I like to keep abreast of relevant data, especially concerning my new country. The woman who wrote this word is too young to have learned formal cursive penmanship in school. She's less than 40.
No answer.
Perhaps she's your friend who came to dinner, because the paper was left on the table among the cartons of food, in what they call the same archaeological layer, which means they were deposited at the same time. Hogan said nothing. The guy asked, "Is your friend who came to dinner less than 40? Hogan said, "She's about 30, I guess." "And she came over for Chinese food and a little wine." No answer. "And maybe some weed, and some gossip about people you both know, and then some serious conversation about your lives and the state of the world." "I suppose," Hogan said. In the middle of which she suddenly jumped up and found a scrap of paper and wrote a single rare and subtle word in a foreign language completely unknown to most Americans. "Can you explain that to me?" She's a smart person. Maybe she was talking about something. Maybe it was the exact right word if it's so rare and subtle. Smart people do that. They use foreign words. Maybe she wrote it down for me, so I could look it up later. "Possible," the guy said. "Some other time, I might have shrugged my shoulders and let it go at that. Stranger things have happened. Except I don't like coincidences, especially not four all at once. First coincidence is she wasn't here alone. She had a male partner. Second coincidence is I've seen that rare word a lot in the last 12 hours, in text messages on my phone, contained in descriptions of our male fugitive. Like I said at the beginning, a man and a woman. I said she's small and dark, and he's big and ugly." Upstairs in the hallway, Abby whispered, "This is going to turn bad." Like a waitress, smelling a bar fight coming. "Probably," Reacher said. Below them, they heard the guy say, "The third coincidence is that a phone with copies of those same messages on it was stolen last night. At one point recently, it was switched on for 20 minutes. No calls were made or received, but 20 minutes is long enough to read plenty of texts. Long enough to note down the hard words to work on later." Hogan said, "Lighten up, man. No one had a stolen phone." "The fourth coincidence is that the stolen phone was stolen by the big, ugly guy in the description. We know that for sure. We got a full report. The guy was acting alone at the time, but he is known to associate with a small, dark-haired woman, who was undoubtedly your dinner guest, because she wrote the word on the paper. Undoubtedly, she copied it from the stolen phone. Because how else would she know that word? Why else would she be interested in that word right now?"
"I don't know, man," Hogan said. "Maybe we're talking about different people."
"He went out and stole the phone and brought it back to her. Did she instruct him to ahead of time? Is she his boss? Did she send him on a mission?"
"I have no clue what you're talking about, man."
"Then you better get a clue," the guy said. "You have been caught harboring enemies of the community. Doesn't reflect well on you."
"Whatever," Hogan said.
"You want to move out of state?"
"I would prefer you to."
Silence for a long moment. Then the guy spoke again, some new menace in his voice, some new thought. He said,
"Did they walk or drive?"
"Who?"
"The man and the woman you were harboring."
"We weren't harboring diddly squat. We had friends over for dinner."
"Walk or drive?"
"When?"
"When they left your house at the end of the evening. When they didn't stay over."
"They walked."
"Do they live close by?"
"Not very," Hogan said cautiously.
"So a walk of some length. We're watching these blocks very carefully. We didn't see a man and a woman walking home. Maybe they had a car parked around the corner.
We didn't see a man and a woman driving home either. Maybe you missed them. I don't think we would have. Then I can't help you, man. The guy said, I know they were here. I saw the food they ate. I have the note they transcribed from the stolen phone. Tonight, these are the most heavily watched blocks in the city. They were not seen leaving. Therefore, they're still here. I think they're upstairs, right now. Silence for another long moment. Then Hogan said, You're a pain in the ass, man. Go ahead up and take a look. Three rooms, all of them empty. Then get out of the house and don't come back. Don't send an invitation to the picnic. In the hallway upstairs, Abby whispered, We could still climb out the window. We didn't make the bed, Reacher whispered back. And I decided we need this guy's car. We can't let him leave anyway. Why do we need his car? Something I just realized we need to do. Below them, the guy's footsteps crossed the hallway, toward the bottom of the stairs. A heavy tread. The old floor creaked and yielded under it. Reacher left his gun in his pocket. He didn't want to use it. A gunshot on a city street at night is going to get a reaction. Too many complications. Evidently, the Albanian guy thought the same way. His right hand snaked into view and gripped the stair rail. No gun. His left hand followed. No gun. But they were big hands. Smooth and hard. Broad and discolored. Thick, blunt fingers. With what looked like a manicure done by a steak mallet. The guy stepped up on the bottom stair. Big shoe. Large size. Wide fitting. Thick, heavy legs. Bulky shoulders. A too tight suit jacket. Maybe 6'2", maybe 220. Not a scrappy little Adriatic guy. A big side of beef. Once upon a time, a police detective in Tirana. Maybe size was a requirement. Maybe it got better results. The guy kept on climbing. Reacher backed away out of sight. He figured he would step up and say hello just as the guy got to the top, from where he had the furthest to fall. All the way back down again. Maximum distance. Better than just falling on the floor. More efficient. The footsteps kept on coming. Every board squeaked. Reacher waited. The guy got to the top. Reacher stepped out. The guy stared at him. Reacher said, Tell me about the rare and subtle word. In the hallway below, he heard Hogan say, Oh, shit. The guy at the top of the stairs didn't answer. Reacher said, Tell me about the bunch of meanings. Repulsive to the eye, no doubt. Unpleasant to look at. Hideous. Offensive. Unsightly. Base. Degraded. Vile. Repellent. All that good modern-day stuff. But if it's originally an old folk word from years ago, then it's mostly about fear. In most languages, the words share a root. Things you feared, you called ugly. The creature who lived in the forest was never handsome. The guy didn't answer. Reacher said, Are you guys scared of me? No reply. Reacher said, Take out your phone and place it on the floor at your feet. The guy said, No. And your car keys. No. I'm going to take them anyway, Reacher said. Up to you when and how. The same gaze. Steady, calm, amused, predatory, unhinged. At that point, the guy had two basic choices. He could think of something clever to say back, or he could skip the whole talk fest altogether and move straight to the action. Reacher was genuinely uncertain which way he would jump. Downstairs, he had seemed to like the sound of his own voice, that was for sure. Once upon a time, a police detective. He liked holding court. He liked revealing how the crime was solved. On the other hand, banter alone wasn't going to win the day. He knew that. Sooner or later, something of substance would have to be thrown in the mix. Why not start at the end? The guy launched off the head of the stairs, off powerful legs, shoulders up, head down,
aiming to charge, aiming to plant a shoulder in Reacher's chest, aiming to knock him backward off balance. But Reacher was at least 50% ready, and he twitched forward toward the guy and threw a vicious right uppercut, except not vertically, more out at a 45-degree angle, so that the guy's charging, ducking face met it exactly square on, his own onrushing 220 meeting Reacher's opposite direction 250 in a colossal rupture of kinetic energy, face against fist, enough to lift the guy up off his heels and dump him down on his butt. Except the floor wasn't there. So the guy somersaulted backward down the stairs, one complete flailing rotation, wide and high, and then he crashed against the bottom wall in a spatter of limbs, like a train wreck. From which he got up, more or less immediately. He blinked twice and staggered once and then stood up straight, like in an afternoon movie, like a monster taking an artillery shell to the chest and swiping absent-mindedly at a scorched patch of fur with a battered paw, all the while staring forward implacably. Reacher started down the stairs. The hallway at the bottom was narrow. Barton and Hogan were backing away into the front parlor, through the open door. The Albanian guy was standing still, tall and proud and hard as a rock, apparently resentful at his recent treatment. His nose was bleeding. Hard to tell if it was broken. Hard to tell if there was anything left to break. The guy was no spring chicken. He had lived a hard life. A police detective in Tirana. The guy took a step forward. Reacher matched it. They both knew. Sooner or later, all you could do was slug it out. The guy feinted left and threw a snap right, low, aimed for Reacher's center mass, the straightest path to the target. But Reacher saw it coming and twisted away and took it on a slab of muscle high on his side, which hurt, but not as much as it would have where it was headed before. The twist away was a pure reflex action, a jammed wide-open panic response from his automatic nervous system, a sudden breathtaking gasp of adrenaline, no finesse at all, no modulation, no precision, just maximum available torque, instantly applied, which was a lot. Which meant there was a lot of stored energy just hanging there for a split second, like a giant spring tightly wound, ready to suddenly unwind in the opposite direction, with exactly the same violent speed and force, a perfect equal and opposite reaction, but this time controlled and timed and aimed and crafted. This time with the returning elbow setting out on an arc of its own, like a guided missile coming up, riding the background rotation of his center mass, adding extra relative velocity of its own, then chopping down hard against the side of the guy's head, a fraction above and in front of his ear, a colossal blow, like getting hit with a baseball bat or an iron bar. It would have busted most skulls, it meant. It would have killed most guys. All it did to the Albanian was bounce him off the parlor doorframe and drop him to his knees. From which he got up immediately. He rose vertically on straightening legs, hands out wide and moving, as if seeking extra leverage or balance, as if swimming through a thick and viscous fluid. Reacher stepped in and hit him again, the same elbow, but from the other direction, on the forehand, not the backhand, above the left eye, bone against bone, jarring, the guy falling back, eyes blank, but inevitably recovering and blinking and stepping up once more, this time not stopping, this time swinging straight into a snapping roundhouse right aimed at the left side of Reacher's face, but not getting there, because Reacher hunched into it and let it glance off his shoulder. And this time Reacher didn't stop either. He spun out of the hunch, this time with his left elbow leading, unexpected, scything around, clubbing down, hitting the guy in the face, below the eye, to the side of the nose, where the roots of the front teeth run. Whatever that part was called. The guy staggered back and clutched at the parlor doorframe, and then kind of fell around it into the room, like tripping over it, but vertically, whirling backward, helpless. Reacher followed and saw the guy go down. He bounced off the immense 8-speaker cabinet and thumped on his back on the floor. He put his hand under his suit coat. Reacher stopped. Don't do it, he thought.
reaction, complications. I don't care what kind of accommodations you think you got. The law moved slow, as Mrs. Shevick knew. She had no time for slow. Out loud, he said, "Don't do it." The guy paid no attention.
Chapter 31. The big, blunt hand slid higher under the coat, the palm flattening, opening, the fingertips seeking ahead for the butt of the gun. Probably a Glock, like the other guy. Point and shoot. Or not, preferably. Reacher scoped out the time and the space and the relative distance. The guy's hand still had inches to travel, a grip still to organize, a draw, an aim, all while lying on his back and maybe groggy from blows to the head. In other words, slow, but still faster than Reacher could beat under the circumstances. Because whatever else, the guy's hand was already way up high under his coat, slow as it was, whereas both of Reacher's hands were still down below his waist, held low and away from his sides, wrists bent back in a "whoa, calm down, don't do it" kind of gesture, far from his jacket pockets. Not that he wanted to use a gun. Not that he needed to. He saw a better alternative, somewhat improvised, by no means perfect. On the upside, it would get the job done. No question about that. With an extremely rapid deployment time, followed by speed and efficiency thereafter, that was the good news. On the downside, it was almost certainly a gross breach of etiquette, almost certainly professionally offensive, also no doubt personally offensive. Like guys out west with their hats. Some things you just didn't touch. Some things you had to. Reacher snatched Barton's Fender bass out of its stand and gripped it vertically by the neck and instantly smashed it straight down, end on into the Albanian guy's throat. Like thrusting a post hole shovel deep into hard-packed dirt. Same kind of action, same kind of aim, same kind of violent stabbing downward force. The Albanian guy went still. Reacher put the guitar back in its stand. "I apologize," he said. "I hope I didn't damage it."
"Don't worry," Barton said. "It's a Fender Precision. It's a 10-pound plank of wood. I got it from a pawn shop in Memphis, Tennessee for $34. I'm sure worse things have happened in its life."
The clock in Reacher's head showed 4:10 in the morning. The guy on the floor was still breathing, but in a shallow, desperate kind of a way, with a reedy plastic wheeze, in and out, as fast as he could, like panting, but without getting anywhere. Probably the fault of the strap button on the bottom of the guitar, punching a half inch ahead of the mass of the body itself. Probably clipped a vital component, larynx, or pharynx, or some other kind of essential structure, made of cartilage and spelled with letters from late in the alphabet. The guy's eyes were rolled up in his head. His fingers were scrabbling gently against the floor, as if trying to get a grip or a purchase on something. Reacher squatted down and went through his pockets and took his gun and his phone and his wallet and his car keys. The gun was another Glock 17, not recent vintage, worn, but well-maintained. The phone was a flat black thing with a glass screen, the same as every other phone. The wallet was a black leather item molded by time into the shape of a potato. It was stuffed with hundreds of dollars in cash and a raft of cards, and a local in-state driver's license with the guy's picture on it and the name Gazim Hoja. He was 47 years old. He drove a Chrysler, according to the logo on his car keys. Hogan asked, "What are we going to do with him?" Abby said, "We can't let him go. We can't keep him here." Barton said, "He needs medical attention." "No," Reacher said. "He waived that right when he knocked on the door."
"That's harsh, man."
"Would he take me to the hospital? Or you?" "The shoe on the other foot. That's what sets the bar. Anyway, we can't. Hospitals ask too many questions."
"We can answer their questions. We were in the right. He pushed his way in. He was a home invader."
Try telling that to a cop getting a grand a week under the table.
Could go either way. Could take years. We don't have time. He might die. You say that like it's a bad thing.
Well, isn't it?
I would trade him for the Shevik's daughter, if you asked me to put a value on things. Anyway, he hasn't died so far. Maybe not in the peak of condition, but he's hanging in there.
So what are we going to do with him?
We need to stash him somewhere, just temporarily, out of sight, out of mind, out of harm's way, until we know for sure one way or the other.
Know what?
What his long-term fate is likely to be. Silence for a beat. Then Barton asked,
Where could we stash him?
In the trunk of his car, Reacher said. He'll be safe and secure. Maybe not very comfortable, but a crick in the neck is the least of his problems right now.
He could get out, Hogan said. They have a safety device now. A plastic handle that glows in the dark. It pops the trunk from the inside.
Not in a gangster car, Reacher said. I'm sure they removed it. He lifted the guy under the arms, and Hogan lifted him by the feet, and they carried him out to the hallway, where Abby scooted ahead and opened the street door. She craned out in the dark and checked left and right. She waved an all clear, and Reacher and Hogan lurched out with the guy across the sidewalk. The car on the curb was a black sedan, with a low roof and a high waistline, which made the windows look shallow from top to bottom, like slots. They reminded Reacher of the vision ports in the side of an armored vehicle. Abby put her hand in Reacher's pocket and found the guy's key. She blipped it, and the trunk lid raised up. Reacher dumped the guy's shoulders in first, and then Hogan shuffled around and folded the guy's legs in afterward. Reacher checked all around the inside of the lock. No glow in the dark handle. Removed. Hogan stepped away. Reacher looked down at the guy. Ghazim Hoxha. 47 years old, once a police detective in Tirana. He closed the trunk lid on him and stepped away to join the others. Once a police detective in the United States Army. Hogan said, We can't leave the car here, not right outside the house, especially not with their boy in the trunk. Sooner or later, they'll cruise by and spot it and check it. Reacher nodded. Abby and I need to use it, he said. We'll park it someplace else when we're done. You're going to drive around with him in the trunk? Keep your enemies close.
Where are we going? Abby asked.
When the guy in the trunk talked about people getting banned from playing in their clubs, I thought, yeah, that's obviously a problem, because they got to eat. Then I remembered saying the same words to you once before, when we stopped at the gas station deli counter on the way to visit with the Sheviks. You asked, were they okay with that? I said, They got to eat. Their cupboards are always bare, especially now. I bet they haven't left the house since the Ukrainians arrived out front. I know how people are. They would be shy and embarrassed and scared to walk past the car, and certainly neither one would let the other do it alone, and they wouldn't do it together either because then the house would be empty behind them, and they would be suspicious. The Ukrainians would sneak in and rummage through their underwear drawers. So, all things considered, I bet they didn't eat anything yesterday and won't eat anything today. We need to take them some food.
What about the car out front of their house?
We'll go in the back, probably through someone else's yard. We'll do the last part on foot. First, they drove to the giant supermarket on the road out of town. Like most such places, it was open all night, cold. Empty, vast, cavernous, flooded with bright, hard light. They rolled a cart the size of a bathtub through the aisles, and they filled it up with four of everything they could think of. Reacher paid at the checkout register, all in cash, all from Ghazim Hoxha's potato-shaped wallet. It seemed like the least the guy could do under the circumstances. They packed the groceries carefully into six balanced bags. Doing the last part on foot meant carrying them. Maybe a decent distance, maybe over gates and fences. They unlocked the Chrysler and lined up the bags on the rear seat. There was no sound from the trunk, no commotion, nothing at all. Abby wanted to check if the guy was okay.
What if he isn't? Reacher said. What are you going to do about it?
Nothing, I guess.
No point checking, then.
How long are we going to leave him in there?
As long as it takes. He should have thought about all this before. I don't see how his welfare suddenly becomes my responsibility, just because he chose to attack my welfare first. I'm not clear how that works exactly. They started it. They can't expect me to provide a health plan.
We should be magnanimous in victory. Someone said that.
Full disclosure, Reacher said. I told you before. I'm a certain kind of person. Is the guy in the trunk still breathing?
I don't know,
Abby said. But there's a possibility.
Yes, there's a possibility.
That's me being magnanimous in victory. Normally I kill them, kill their families, and piss on their ancestors' graves.
I never know when you're kidding me.
I guess that's true. Are you saying you're not kidding me now? I'm saying, in my case, magnanimity is in short supply.
You're taking food to an old couple in the middle of the night.
That's a different word than magnanimous.
Still a nice gesture.
Because one day I could be them. But I'll never be the guy in the trunk.
So it's purely tribal,
Abby said. Your kind of people or the other kind?
My kind of people or the wrong kind. Who's in your tribe?
Almost nobody, Reacher said. I live a lonely life. They drove the Chrysler back toward town and took the left that led them into the east side hinterland, through the original city blocks and out toward where the Sheviks lived. The old post-war development lay up ahead. By that point, Reacher felt he knew it well enough. He figured they could get to a parallel street without the Ukrainians ever seeing them pass by, even at a distance. They could sneak around to the rear of the block and park outside the Sheviks' back-to-back neighbor's house. The Chrysler would be lined up with the Lincoln, more or less exactly, nose to nose and tail to tail, but about 200 feet apart, the depth of two small residential lots, two buildings in the way. They cut the lights and idled through the narrow streets, slowly, in the dark. They took a right, ahead of their usual turn, and a left, and they eased to a stop in what they were sure was the right spot. Outside, the Sheviks' back-to-back neighbor. A ranch house with pale siding and an asphalt roof. The same, but different. The front half of the structure butted out into an open front yard. The rear half of the structure was included in a large rectangle of head-high fence that ran all around the backyard. To get a mower from front to back, there was a fold-back section of fence, like a gate. The house had five windows facing the street. One had drapes closed tight behind it. Probably a bedroom. People sleeping.
Abby said, "Suppose they see us."
Reacher said, "They're asleep."
"Suppose they wake up?"
"Doesn't matter."
"They'll call the cops."
"Probably not. They'll look out the window and see a gangster car. They'll close their eyes and hope it goes away again. By morning, if anyone were to ask them, they'll have decided the safest approach is to have forgotten all about it. They'll say, 'What car?'" Reacher turned the motor off. He said, "A dog would be a bigger problem. It might start barking. There might be others around. They could set up a big commotion. The Ukrainians might get out to check. Out of sheer boredom, if nothing else."
"We bought steaks," Abby said. "We have raw meat in those bags."
"Is a dog's sense of smell better than its hearing, or is it the other way around?"
"They're both pretty good."
About a third of U.S. households own a dog, just over 36% to be precise, which gives us a little worse than a 2 in 3 chance of being okay. Plus, maybe it won't bark anyway. Maybe the neighborhood dogs are calm. Maybe the Ukrainians are too lazy to get out to check. Too warm, too comfortable. Maybe they're fast asleep. I think it's safe enough.
"What time is it?"
Abby asked. "Just past 5:20.
"I was thinking about that line I told you, about doing something that scares you every day. Except it's only 5:20 in the morning and I'm already on my second thing."
"This one doesn't count," Reacher said. "This one is a walk in the park. Maybe literally. Maybe their landscaping is nice."
"Also on the subject of 5:20 in the morning?
Surely the Sheviks won't be up yet.
They might be. I can't imagine they're sleeping well at the moment. If I'm wrong and they are sleeping well, you can wake them up. You can call them on your phone when we get there. You can tell them we're right outside their kitchen window. Tell them not to turn on any lights at the front of the house. An undisturbed visit is what we want. They got out of the car and stood for a second in the silence. The night was gray and the air was damp with mist. Still no noise from the trunk. No kicking, no banging, no yelling. Nothing. They hauled the grocery bags off the rear bench and divided them up. Two and two for Reacher, one and one for Abby. Neither one of them overburdened or lopsided. Good to go. They stepped into the neighbor's front yard.
Chapter 32. It was too dark to tell whether the landscaping was nice, but by smell and feel and inadvertent physical contact, they could tell it was conventionally planted, with the normal kind of stuff in the normal kind of places. At first underfoot was a lawn of tough, springy grass, maybe some new hybrid strain, slick and cold with nighttime damp. Then came a crunchy area, some kind of broken slate or shale, maybe a path, maybe a mulch. And beyond it came spiky and coniferous foundation plantings that scratched loudly at the grocery bags as they brushed by. Then came the fold-back section of fence, which, judging by the state of the lawn, got hauled open and shut at least once every couple of weeks, all season long. Even so, it was stiff and noisy. At one point early in its travel, it let out a wood-on-wood sound somewhere between a yelp and a bark and a shriek and a groan. Brief, but loud. They waited. No reaction. No dog. They squeezed through the gap they had opened, shuffling sideways, groceries leading, groceries following. They walked through the backyard. Up ahead in the gloom was the back fence, which was also the Sheviks' back fence. In reverse, a mirror image, theoretically, if they were in the right place.
"We're good," Abby whispered. "This is it. Has to be. Can't go wrong. Like counting squares on a chessboard."
Reacher stood up tall on tiptoe and looked over the fence. He saw a gray nighttime view of the back of a ranch house with pale siding and an asphalt roof. The same, but different. But the right place. He recognized it by the way part of the lawn met the back wall of the house. It was the spot where the family photographs had been taken. The GI and the girl in the hoop skirt, with raw dirt at their feet. The same couple on a year-old lawn with a baby. The same couple 8 years later with 8-year-old Maria Shevik, on grass by then lush and thick. Same patch of lawn. Same length of wall. The kitchen light was on. "They're up," Reacher said. Climbing the fence was difficult because it was in poor condition. The rational approach would have been to bust through it or kick it down, which they ruled out on ethical grounds. Instead, they spent more than half their climbing energy fighting for equilibrium, trying to keep their weight vertical, not out to the side. They wobbled back and forth like a circus act. They sensed a point beyond which the whole thing would collapse, like a long, rotten, rippling curtain, maybe the whole width of the yard. Abby went first and made it, and Reacher passed her the 6 grocery bags, one at a time, laboriously, hoisting each one high over the fence, and then letting it down as low as he could, the top of the cedar board digging into the crook of his elbow, until it was low enough for her to reach up and safely take. Then came his turn to climb. He was twice as heavy and 3 times as clumsy. The fence swayed and yawed a yard one way, then a yard the other. But he got it stabilized and held it steady, and then kind of rolled off, in an inelegant maneuver that left him on his back in a flower bed, but also left the fence still standing. They carried the groceries to the kitchen door and tapped on the glass. Heart attack time, potentially, for the Sheviks, but they survived. There was a little gasping and fluttering of fingers and fanning for breath, and a little embarrassment about bathrobes, but they got over it fast enough. They stared at the grocery sacks with a mixture of emotions on their faces. Shame. And lost pride, and empty stomachs. Reacher got them to make coffee. Abby packed their refrigerator and stacked their shelves.
Mariashevic said, "We're up because we got a call from the hospital. It's an around-the-clock operation, obviously. We told them they should call any time, night or day. It's in our notes, I expect. They called to say they want to do another scan, first thing tomorrow morning. They're still excited. If we pay," Aronshevik said. "How much this time?" Reacher asked. $11,000. "When?" "We need it by close of business today." "I guess you already looked under the sofa cushions." "I found a button from a pair of my pants. It was missing 8 years. Maria sewed it back on." "It's still early in the day," Reacher said. "There are still a lot of hours to go before the close of business." "We were going to skip it this time around," Aaron said. "After all, what will it tell us? If it's good news, it will make us happy, of course. But that's self-indulgence, not medicine. If it's bad news, we don't want to know anyway. So we weren't sure exactly what we would be getting for our $11,000. But then the doctors said they need to know the extent of the progress. They said they need to calibrate a new dosage based on what they find, either up or down, with a certain amount of timing and precision. They said anything else would be perilous. How do you normally pay them?" "With a bank wire."
"Do they take cash?"
"Why?" "Cash is usually the quickest thing to rustle up when time is running short."
"From where?"
"Every day presents different opportunities. Worst case scenario, we could sell their car. Maybe up at the Ford dealer. I heard their used lot needs inventory."
"Yes. They take cash," Shevik said. "Like a casino. They have a line of tellers behind bulletproof glass."
"Okay," Reacher said. "Good to know." He stepped out to the darkened hallway and lined up at a distance with a front window. He looked out to the street. The Lincoln was still there, the same one, big and black, now dewed over and inert. Two vague shapes in it, heads and shoulders slumped down in the gloom. Guns under their arms, no doubt. Wallets in their pockets, almost certainly. Probably stuffed with cash, if they were anything like their opposite number from Tirana. Probably hundreds of dollars, but probably not 11,000. He stepped back to the kitchen. Mariashevic gave him a cup of coffee, his first of the day. She asked them to stay for breakfast. She would fix it. They could all eat together, like a party. Reacher wanted to say no. The food was for the old folks themselves, not random guests. Plus, he wanted to get out of there before the sun came up, while it was still dark. It was likely to be a busy day. There was a lot to do. But the breakfast idea seemed to mean something to the Sheviks, and Abby was okay with it, so he said yes. Much later, he wondered exactly how much different the day would have turned out if he hadn't. But he didn't think about it for long. Spilled milk. Wasted energy. Move on. Mariashevic grilled bacon and fried eggs and made toast and brewed a second pot of coffee. Aaron tottered in with the stool from their bedroom dressing table to make a fourth seat. Maria was right. In the end, the meal turned into a party, like a secret in the dark. Abby told a joke about a guy with cancer. For a beat, it could have gone either way, but her performer's instinct was sure and true. After a second of silence, Aaron and Maria burst out laughing, hard, their shoulders heaving, on and on, some kind of pent-up relief coming out, some kind of catharsis. Maria slapped her hand on the table, so hard her coffee spilled, and Aaron drummed his feet on the floor, so hard he hurt his knee again. Reacher watched the sun come up. The sky went gray, then gold. The yard out the window took shape. Vague forms loomed out of the dark. The fence, the distant hump of the back-to-back neighbor's asphalt roof. "Who lives there?" he asked. "Whose yard did we walk through?"
"Actually, it's the woman who told us about Fisnik," Aaron said.
She told us the story about the other neighbor's nephew's wife's cousin borrowing money from a gangster in a bar. I have a feeling she went to see him herself a little later. She got her car fixed all of a sudden. No other visible means of support. Maria made a third pot of coffee. Reacher thought, what the hell? The sun was already over the horizon. He stayed in his seat and drank his share. Then somehow, the conversation came back to money, and suddenly everyone seemed to hear the same clock ticking. The close of business, getting nearer. Except cash is good all night long, Reacher said, right? The close of business thing is about the bank wires only. As long as they have a teller open, we're good until the moment they put her on the gurney. From where? Aaron said again. 11,000 is a lot of sofa cushions. Hope for the best, Reacher said. He and Abby left the way they had come, this time with empty hands, and in the late dawn light, therefore faster, but not much easier. The fence was still difficult. The foldback section was still stiff and noisy. Their car was gone. Chapter 33. The black Chrysler, with its low roof and its high waistline and its shallow windows and its closed trunk lid, no longer there. The space at the curb was empty. Abby said, the guy got out. I don't see how he could, Reacher said. Then what happened? My fault, Reacher said. I got it ass backward. About the public response. The woman looked out the window and saw a gangster car and didn't get nervous. She called Gangster HQ instead. Maybe she's obliged to. Maybe it was part of her deal with Fisnik when she got her car fixed. They claimed to have eyes everywhere. Maybe that's how. So she called them, and they came right over, and they checked it out. Did they open the trunk? Operationally, we have to assume they did. Equally, we have to assume the guy is still functioning, which puts Barton and Hogan in immediate danger. They're probably fast asleep right now. You better call them. If they're asleep, their phones will be off. Try anyway. She did. Their phones were off. That language guy, Reacher said, the tanker. Did you get his number? Ventresca? Yes. No. Okay, Reacher said. We're leaving here on foot. No choice. The small, slender woman and the big, ugly man. Broad daylight. Eyes everywhere. Probably not a walk in the park anymore. Probably your second thing of the day. Back to Frank Barton's house? We need to warn them somehow. I'll keep trying the phone. But they'll sleep till 10. You know how it is. Their gig starts at 12. Wait, Reacher said. You can find Ventresca on your phone. He said he had a private security license, and his number was listed in the national directories. Abby searched. She typed and swiped and tapped and scrolled. She said, got him. Then she said, it looks like it's just an office landline. He won't be in yet. Try anyway. She did. She put the phone on speaker and held it balanced on her palm. They heard a series of clicks, as if the call was being bounced from one place to another. She said, maybe out of hours it forwards to his house. It did exactly that. Ventresca answered. He sounded all squared away. He sounded crisp and alert and cheerful and corporate. He said, Ventresca Security, how may I help you? Reacher said, Guy, this is Reacher, the MP. Abby and I got your number from a directory. On that thing everyone talks about. The internet? That's it. But this is not official, okay? Not for the after-action report. Okay. Also, it's a shoot-first kind of thing. Just do it right now and ask questions later. Do what right now? Go check your pal Joe Hogan is okay, and Frank Barton. Why wouldn't they be? I said questions later. That one now. The Albanians may be close to confirming where we were last night. May already have confirmed. Hogan and Barton aren't answering their phones. We hope because they're asleep. Okay, on my way. Get them out of there, even if they're okay so far. Could go south any time. Where will they go? They can go crash at my house, Abby said. No one is watching it anymore. How long do they need to be gone? A day, Reacher said.
That seems to be the way the wind is blowing. No need to pack a big suitcase.
Vantreska clicked off. Abby put her phone away. Reacher redistributed the things in his pockets to balance his load. Abby buttoned her coat. They set out walking. A small woman and a big man. Broad daylight. Eyes everywhere.
Gregory had said he would go talk to Dino again, first thing in the morning, and what Gregory said, Gregory meant. He got up early and dressed the same way he had before on his previous visit. Tight pants, tight shirt, nothing to hide. No gun, no knife, no wire, no bomb. Necessary, but not comfortable. The dawn air was too cold for single layers. He waited for a little warmth, and until there were shadows. He wanted daylight hours to be visibly underway. It was a matter of presentation. He was a man of energy and vigor, as fresh as the new day, taking charge, taking action, bright and early. Not a mistimed nightcrawler coming in out of the gloom. Once again, he drove to the garage on Center Street. Then he walked. Once again, he was followed all the way. Once again, calls were made ahead. When he got where he was going, he found the same six figures, in the same half circle between the sidewalk and the lumberyard's gate, like chess pieces, the same defensive formation. Once again, one of the six figures stepped up. It was Yetmir. Once again, partly a blocking maneuver, and partly ready to listen. Gregory told him, "I need to speak with Dino." Yetmir asked, "Why?"
"I have a proposal."
"What kind?"
"At this point, it's for his ears only."
"On what general subject?"
"A matter of urgent mutual interest."
"Mutual," Yetmir said. "A concept in short supply recently." An impertinence, given their disparity in rank. Only one step apart, but it was the biggest step of all. But Gregory didn't react. He said, "I believe we were both deceived." Yetmir paused a beat.
"In what way?" he said. "The fox got the blame, but really it was the dog who did it. You probably have a folk tale in your culture, or a similar saying." "Who is the dog?" Yetmir asked.
Gregory didn't answer directly. Instead, he said, "That's for Dino's ears only."
"No," Yetmir said. "Given the history of recent days, you'll understand that Dino will not feel well disposed toward taking a meeting with you at this time. Not without an extensive preview of the issue at hand, and a good word, both from me. I'm sure you would operate in the same manner under the same circumstances. You have a staff for a reason. So does Dino." Gregory said, "Tell him we didn't start killing your guys, and I don't believe you started killing our guys. Ask him if he could get on board with that theory."
"And if he can?"
"Ask him what it means."
"What does it mean?"
"That's enough of a preview. Now I'm requesting the courtesy of a meeting."
"Then who killed our guys? And yours?
You're saying someone was running a false flag operation against both of us at once."
Gregory said nothing.
"Yes or no answer," Yetmir said. "Do you believe there was outside interference?"
"Yes," Gregory said.
"Then we should talk. Dino delegated the matter to me."
"This is above your pay grade. With respect, there's a reason staffs have bosses."
"Dino isn't here," Yetmir said.
"When will he get in?"
"He was in early. He already left again."
"I'm serious," Gregory said. "This is very urgent."
"Then talk to me. Dino will tell you to anyway. Right now, you're wasting time."
Gregory said, "Did they take phones from you?"
Yetmir paused a long moment. He said, "You ask, because clearly they took phones from you.
which would indicate an imminent data attack, which narrows the field when it comes to potential opponents. We think narrows it all the way down to the only one who would dare.
Dino will say you Ukrainians are always obsessed with the Russians. It's a well-known fact. You would accuse them of anything. Suppose this time it's true. Neither one of us can beat the Russians. Not separately. Is that your proposal? I'll make sure Dino gets it.
I'm serious, Gregory said again. This is very urgent.
I'm taking it seriously. Dino will get back to you as soon as he can. Maybe he'll walk over to see you himself, to the taxi office,
where he will be treated with the same courtesy I have enjoyed here.
Perhaps we'll become accustomed to trusting each other,
Yetmir said. Time alone will tell, Gregory said.
Perhaps we'll become friends.
Gregory had no answer to that. He walked away, out of the scoop, onto the sidewalk, and west, towards center. Yetmir stood and watched him go. Then he turned away and ducked back inside, through the Judas Gate, to the low corrugated shed, with the smell of pine and the whine of saws, where his cell phone rang, with bad news. A made man from the night watch by the name of Gazim Hoxha had been found half dead in the trunk of his own car, abandoned way out on the edge of a ticky-tack old housing development. A tip had been called in by one of their old money-lending customers, hoping for points off her next loan. At that time, no suspects had yet been identified. But a careful search of the area was already underway. There were extra cars on the streets. There were plenty of eyes wide open.
Reacher and Abby threaded their way out of the Shevik's development by following their inward route in reverse, keeping well out of sight of the parked Ukrainian car, staying on side streets wherever possible until the very last moment when they had to make a right and join the main drag that led past the gas station with the deli counter and on toward downtown. Up until then, they felt pretty good. But from that point onward, the exposure was pitiless. The sun was bright. The air was clear. There was no possibility of concealment. It was a standard urban streetscape. On the left, a three-story brick facade with dusty windows and mean doors. Then a brick sidewalk and a stone curb and a blacktop street and a stone curb and a brick sidewalk. On the right, a three-story brick facade with dusty windows and mean doors. No cover anywhere taller than a hydrant or wider than a light pole. Only a matter of time. Abby's phone rang. She answered. Vantreska. She put him on speaker. She walked with her phone out in front of her, carried flat on her hand. She looked like a carving from an old Egyptian tomb. Vantreska said, I got Barton and Hogan. They're okay. They're right here in the car with me. They told me what happened last night. No one has been to their house since then.
Reacher asked, where are you now?
We're setting out over to Abby's, like she said. Barton knows where it is.
No. Come pick us up first.
They told me you had a car.
Unfortunately, it just got repossessed, with the guy still in the trunk, which is why I was worried about Barton's address.
No one has been to the house, Vantreska said again. Not so far.
Clearly the guy isn't talking yet. Maybe he can't.
Barton told me about the precision bass. A blunt instrument, Reacher said.
But the point is right now we're walking. Right now our asses are hanging out in the breeze. We need a rendezvous for an emergency evacuation.
Where are you exactly?
Which was a difficult question. There were no legible street signs. They were either faded or rusted out or missing altogether. Maybe hit by a streetcar the year the Titanic went down. The year Fenway Park opened for business. Abby did something with her phone. She kept Vantreska on the line and came up with a map. There were pointers and arrows and pulsing blue spheres. She read out the street and the cross street.
5 minutes, Vantreska said. Maybe 10. Morning rush hour is coming. What is the exact location for the pickup?
Another good question.
They couldn't stand on the corner like they were hailing a taxi, not if exposure was their main concern. Reacher looked all around. Unpromising. Small commercial enterprises, not yet open. All faintly seedy. The kind of places where gray-faced individuals weaseled in about 10 o'clock, after a last furtive backward glance. Reacher knew cities. On the next block, he could see a waist-high double-sided chalkboard tented on the sidewalk, which probably meant a coffee shop, which would be open at that hour, but maybe hostile. No man on the door, in such a place, on such a street, but maybe a sympathizer at the espresso machine, hoping for points off his loan. There, he said. He pointed to a narrow building across the street, about 10 yards farther on. At the front, it was propped up with steeply angled blocks of wood, as if it was in danger of falling down. The wood supports were shrouded in a tough black net. Maybe a local regulation. Maybe the city worried about stressed chips of brick randomly flinging themselves outward from the faulty wall to the detriment of passers-by or those lingering beneath. Whatever the reason, the result in practical terms could be used as an improvised semi-hideaway, because a person could squeeze in behind the net and then just stand there, semi-obscured from view. Maybe 60% obscured. It was a thick net. Maybe 40%. It was a sunny morning. Better than nothing. Abby relayed the information. 5 minutes, Ventresca said again. Maybe 10. What kind of car? Reacher asked him. We don't want to squeeze out again for the wrong people. It's an 05 S-Type R in anthracite over charcoal. Remember what I said about armor people? We glamorize the machine. I didn't understand what any of those words meant. It's a moderately old Jaguar, Ventresca said. The hardcore sports version of the first refresh of the retro model they designed at the end of the 90s, with the upgraded cam followers and the bored-out motor, and the supercharger, obviously. Not helping, Reacher said. Ventresca said, it's a black sedan. He clicked off. Abby put her phone away. They started across the street, on a shallow diagonal, heading for the propped-up building. A car came around the corner. Fast. A black sedan. Too soon. 5 seconds, not 5 minutes. And not an old Jaguar. A new Chrysler, with a low roof and a high waistline and shallow windows. Like slots. Like the vision ports in the side of an armored vehicle. Chapter 34. The black Chrysler came on toward them, then slowed a step, then picked up again, like a stumble, like the automotive equivalent of a double take, as if the car itself couldn't believe what it was seeing. A small, slender woman and a big, ugly man. Suddenly, right there on the street, front and center in the windshield, large as life, be on the lookout. The car jammed to a stop and the front doors opened, both of them, 20 feet away. Two guys, two guns. The guns were Glock 17s. The guys were right-handed. Smaller than Gazim Hoxha, but bigger than the average. Not scrappy little Adriatic guys, that was for sure. Both wore black pants and black t-shirts. And sunglasses. Neither one had shaved. No doubt they had been dragged out of bed and sent on patrol immediately after Hoxha's car had been found. They took a step forward. Reacher glanced left, glanced right. No cover taller than a hydrant or wider than a light pole. He put his hand in his pocket, the H&K that he knew for sure worked, that he also knew for sure he didn't want to use. A gunshot on a city street at night would get a reaction. 10 times worse in the innocent morning sunshine. There would be more officers on the day watch than the night watch. They would all deploy. There would be dozens of cars, lights flashing, sirens going. There would be news helicopters and cell phone video. There would be paperwork. There would be hundreds of hours in a room with a cop and a table screwed to the floor. Abby's phone log would implicate Barton and Hogan and Ventresca. The mess would spread far and wide. Could take weeks to resolve, which Reacher didn't want, and the Sheviks didn't have. The guys with the Glocks took another step.
They were coming in from wide, around their thrown-open doors, guns first, shuffling steps, rigid two-handed grips, concentrated squints over their front sights. Another step, and another. Then the guy on Reacher's right, who had been the driver, kept on coming, but the other guy stopped. The passenger. A wheel play. Like sheepdogs. They wanted to get one of them around and behind, to press Reacher and Abby toward the other one, toward the far sidewalk, toward the three-story wall, where they would finally run out of room. An obvious, instinctive tactic. Which depended on Reacher and Abby first staying where they were, and then rotating meekly in place, and then stumbling backward. Not going to happen. Abby, take a step back, Reacher said, with me. He stepped back. She stepped back. The driver's geometry was distorted. His envelope was enlarged. Now he had further to go. Again, Reacher said. He stepped back. She stepped back.
Stand still, the driver said, or I'll shoot.
Reacher thought, will you? It was one of life's great questions. The guy had all the same structural inhibitions as Reacher himself. The dozens of squad cars, with their lights flashing and their sirens going. The news helicopters and the cell phone video. The paperwork. The hours in the room with the cop. Which would produce an uncertain outcome for the guy. Inevitable. Could go either way. There were no guarantees. Don't frighten the voters. There was a new police commissioner on the way. Plus, the guy had professional obligations to consider. There were questions to be answered. They thought Reacher was an outside agitator. We want to know who you are. There would be bonus points for his capture still able to talk. There would be punishments for his delivery dead or comatose or mortally wounded. Because the dead and the comatose couldn't talk, and the mortally wounded didn't last long enough to talk. When they brought out the spoons, and the electric saws, and the smoothing irons, and the cordless power tools, or whatever other grotesque procedures were favored east of center. So, would the guy shoot? Unlikely, Reacher thought. Probably not, but always possible. Was he prepared to bet his life on it? Probably yes. He had before. He had gambled and won. 10,000 generations later, his instincts were still working. He had walked away and lived to tell the tale. In any case, he was fundamentally indifferent. No one lived forever. But was he prepared to bet Abby's life on it? The driver said, "Show me your hands." Which would be game over. The point of no return right there. Which was getting close anyway. The geometry had gone bad. The driver and the passenger had gotten about 60 degrees apart. They were well positioned for enfilade fire. The likely sequence of events was easy to predict. Reacher would shoot through his pocket and hit the driver. One down. No problem. But then the 60-degree turn toward the passenger would be slow and clumsy, because his hand would be still all snagged up inside his pocket, which would give the passenger time to fire, maybe two or three rounds, which would either hit Abby or Reacher himself, or both, or miss altogether. Almost certainly the lattermost, he thought, in the real world. The guy was already jumpy. By then, he would be startled and panicked. Most handgun rounds missed their target under the best of circumstances. But would he bet Abby's life on that? "Show me your hands," the driver said again. Abby said, "Reacher?" 10,000 generations said, "Stay alive and see what the next minute brings." Reacher took his hands out of his pockets. "Take your jacket off," the driver said. "I can see the weight from here." Reacher took his jacket off. He dropped it on the blacktop. The guns in the pockets bumped and clanked. The Ukrainian HMKs, the Albanian Glocks. His entire arsenal. Almost. The driver said, "Now get in the car." The passenger backed up to the Chrysler. Reacher thought he was going to open the rear door for them, like a guy outside a fancy hotel. But he didn't. He opened the trunk instead. "Good enough for Gazim Hoxha," the driver said. Abby said,
Reacher?
We'll be okay, he said.
How?
He didn't answer. He got in first, crossways, on his side in a U-shape, and then Abby got in the space he was leaving in front of him, curled on her side in a fetal position, like they were spooning in bed. Except they weren't. The passenger closed the lid with a cheap metal clang. The world went dark. No luminous handle. Removed. At that moment, Dino was on the phone to Yetmir. A summons to a meeting in Dino's office, right then, immediately. Clearly, there was something on Dino's mind. Yetmir got there inside 3 minutes and sat down in front of the desk. Dino was looking at his phone, at the long sequence of texts about Kazim Hoxha, found half dead in the trunk of his car, next to an old housing development. Hoxha and I go back a long way, Dino said. I knew him when he was a cop in Tirana. He busted me once.